since he has been a member of the progressive political community in Vermont on and off since 1970 when he came to teach at the University of Vermont. During the two tumultuous years that Michael was on the campus, he provided significant leadership for the anti-war movement at significant expense to himself. After 2 years on the campus, the Board of Trustees convened with a rare meeting of the governor, created something called professional conduct that no one had ever heard before, reversed the entire campus, and fired Parenti for such activities as refusing to pledge allegiance to the flag at a Rotary Club dinner where he was the invited speaker and spoke on the absence of liberty and justice for all in the United States. After his 2 years at UVM, he remained part of the Vermont community and ran in 1974 on the Liberty Union ticket as a candidate for the U.S. Congress, a precursor in many ways of Bernie's run this past year, and received 7% of the vote in that election, gaining the Liberty Union major party status and ballot access for the remainder of that decade. Since teaching at the University of Vermont, Michael has been systematically excluded from regular teaching positions as a penalty for the quality and character of his critique of capitalism and of U.S. imperialism. His recent books include Democracy for the Few, Inventing Reality, The Politics of the Mass Media, and most recently The Sword and the Dollar, Imperialism, Revolution, and the Arms Race, all by St. Martin's Press. Michael is currently doing research work at the Institute for Policy Studies and remains committed to the movement nationally, internationally, and here in Vermont. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Michael Parenti.
Thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to see so many fine Vermont activists again, including my friend Will Miller and Grace Paley and Gus Newport, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And many others who are doing so much so well here. I'm going to talk tonight. My subject is democracy and populist struggle. And I think it's an apt subject, since that's what we're all about. And I think really we should give some thought to democracy and what is meant by democracy. Can everybody hear me okay? No? Yeah. Barely. Oh, is that better?
Yeah.
Well, my subject is democracy and populist struggle. And the subject of democracy is one that has preoccupied me for quite a while. Now, we're said to be the oldest democracy. I heard that again and again. We are a democracy that's 200 years old. But really, when you think about it, how democratic were we starting 200 years ago and going through most of the 19th century? One-third of our population was in slavery until 1864. Indian nations were systematically exterminated. Their lands were stolen. One-half of the population couldn't vote because they were women. Anywhere from 30 to 85% of the white males, depending on what state you were in, couldn't vote because of property restrictions. Child labor became a commonplace thing by mid-century, certainly even more so by late century, and poverty and malnutrition, children. A major unprovoked war of aggression was perpetrated against Mexico, and more than half of Mexico's territory was stolen from it. You ought to keep these things in mind when they talk about the Soviet Union as a gangster nation for taking back the Baltic countries that had belonged to the Tsar and were under a right-wing fascist government until 1940, when the Red Army moved back in on them, or any country that's condemned. We should think about this one, an unprovoked war against Spain later that same century, and a murderous imperialist war. This is the one I'd never heard about, the murderous imperialist war of attrition against the Filipino people. By the way, during that same century, we lost 3,000 men in attacks against Canada, in a war, again, the attempt was to conquered Canada earlier in the century. Yet all through these very undemocratic times, and to this very day, if there wasn't a democracy, a fine and finished product, as our propagandists want us to believe, there were democratic struggles and very important democratic victories. And I believe we must not lose sight of those things. In fact, we wouldn't be here right now with what little resources and whatever ground we've gained, if it weren't for the struggles of these people, most of whose names we don't even know or remember today. But they are the brothers and sisters of our history. What I'm suggesting is that democracy is not a fixed and finished system to be preserved. That's what we're always told. We must preserve our democracy, which usually means don't use it, you know, don't get to preserve our rights. You know how you preserve your right to free speech? You keep quiet. Otherwise, they're going to start attacking us and causing trouble. As if it was some Grecian urn that was handed down to us from Athens, or handed down to us by that gaggle of rich merchants, bankers, and slaveholders known as our founding fathers. Democracy is an ongoing process of self-realization carried out by the people in their quest for a better life, a more just life, a more humane, economic, social, political, and cultural life. And there are two dimensions to democracy. One is the one we always learn about. That's formal democracy, electoral democracy, procedural democracy, the democracy of the Bill of Rights, the democracy which says that you have a democracy when you have competitive elections. And there's no questioning this system's ability to produce competitive elections. We have elections for president, for senate, for house, for state assembly, for state senate, for county level, for mayors, for dog catchers, for supervisors, for all sorts of things, for judgeships. We have elections coming out of the kazoo. But there's another dimension to democracy, many of us have argued. And that's a substantive democracy, not just a procedural one. A class democracy, an economic democracy. That is, democracy is not just about how leaders are selected. It must be measured also by how fair and just it is in its substantive outputs. Not just in the process of its inputs, but what does it actually do for the mass of people in its country? In the treatment of its own common people, and in the treatment of the common people of other nations also. I want to make that point clear. I remember being in a teach-in at Yale, all these Yale faculty during the Vietnam War, talking about whether or not the anti-war movement was really proper because it was violating certain laws, and whether the law wasn't really something that had to be respected, and could one take the law in their own hands. And I made the very humble point that the Vietnamese didn't have an opportunity to engage in this decision-making system, but they were receiving these bombs and being slaughtered. That there was something wrong with that whole cogitation about the law and the majority and the minority and proper procedure and all that sort of thing. And that you had left out, in your worship of proper procedure, you had left out a very improper thing that was happening over there in Vietnam. So it's how the country treats its own common people and the common people of other lands. And if you are an imperialist power, then there's something very severely deficient and so very and a real violation of any kind of democratic precepts. Imperialism is inherently anti-democratic, although, of course, the rationale that is that it's there to protect democracy. We use fascism to protect capitalism, all the while claiming we're defending democracy from communism throughout the Third World. One of the important democratic gains and democratic victories is the battle that's gone on for the last 200 years for improved working conditions. This may seem like a minor issue to those who don't work, but most of us work. You know, most of us have to work. Some of us can not work and just go to conferences and get little groups of followers around us and all that thing. But there are others of us who have to work, you know. We have to work. We're all workers. And the very life chances we endure are part of this thing. And much of the struggle and the expansion of procedural democracy, much of the expansion of political democracy came through a struggle for work democracy, for economic democracy. And that working people learned in the early part of the 19th century that we must change the outcome of this game, because look at the way it's treating us. And to do that, we must get into the game. But to do that, to get into the game, we've got to change the very rules of the game that are excluding us. So much of the fight for substantive gain also included a fight for changing the rules of the game, which allowed you to then make those gains. The enfranchisement of the white male working class in this country came with agitation, struggle, resistance, the struggle for better working conditions, a shorter work a day, better wages. And that struggle, by the way, also included the struggle for the vote, for the right to peaceable assembly, for the right to have some say about state power and to have some say about the laws which regulate us. So much of the fight to extend the franchise, to extend free speech and all that came in the fight for class issues. So the class struggle actually helped in the struggle for economic democracy. And the pursuit of economic democracy led to a broadening of procedural democratic rights. Take the case of the wobbly free speech fights of the 1920s. When the IWW went into townships in the early 20s, you know, in most towns in America in the 20s, there was no free speech for syndicalists, anarchists, socialists, wobblies, communists, union organizers of any kind. You went into that town, you started speaking and organizing, the sheriff and his goons would come and bash your head in, and you ended up spending a week in the slammer and then driven out of town. And that went on through the 20s and even to the part of the 30s. And what the Wobblies did was they started going into towns not with two or three organizers, but with 200 or 300 and 2,000 or 3,000. They came in on horse and wagon and foot, and they rode the rails, and they'd take over the towns, and they created this enormous ferment because they realized in order to better their life conditions, their life chances, in order to live like human beings, they had to be able to organize and gather strength at the workplace, at the point of production. In order to do that, they had to have free speech to organize, and they had to settle this fight of free speech. And those famous wobbly free speech fights percolated and shook the nation for a while, and that's what percolated up to the Supreme Court. And it was then that Oliver Wendell Holmes and those guys sitting up there in their black robes started saying that time overthrows many a fighting faith, and there must be change, and we must tolerate these kinds of things, and the right to dissent, blah, blah, blah. It was when they got and felt the impact, the power of people mobilized and organized and directed against their establishment, that they knew they had to give a little. It's when people developed that power that they gained some modicum of freedom. Procedural rights, therefore, are a reflection of the material conditions of class power in most cases, or group power, whichever. It may not necessarily be just a class issue. We have free speech in groups like this, but we don't have free speech in the corporate media. The corporate media reaches millions of people. Our power has not penetrated those domains. And so the power of free speech in those domains are monopolized by corporate spokespeople like George Will, William Buckley, McLaughlin, and other various establishment pundits. They go from far right to a kind of pale centrist liberal. So power and freedom, while they're often seen as antithetical, power will crush freedom, you know. In fact, power and freedom are very symbiotic. If you don't have the power, you don't have the freedom. To the extent that we have the resources, organization, and history of struggle and victory to meet in this convention the way we do, to operate politically where we can, and at times we can, to the extent we have that kind of power, we have that kind of freedom. And by the way, there's no guarantee that that freedom will always be there should that power be diminished or undermined or undercut. The struggle for women's equality is another example. Women didn't just want the suffrage for the hell of it. They just didn't want the vote for the hell of it. It wasn't something so superficial as a gender ego that made them say, well, you got the vote, so we want the vote too. There were very real pressing life issues that women were facing. Women had, in many states, absolutely no property rights in marriage. They can go a whole lifetime and end up propertyless. They could have property inherited from their family, and it becomes their husband's property. And then he can kick her out 2 years later, and she would be destitute. Women, in many cases, were chattels to their husbands. Women had no protection from abuse. It's not clear that they have all that much protection today. That's still a democratic right. The right to a safe person is an inherent democratic right, which women are still struggling for. Women had no access to medical school training or law school training in most states or professional or graduate schools. You know, you talk to some women today and they're going, where are you going, law school? Where are you going, oh, grad school? They think James Madison wrote that into the Constitution for them, wherever the hell it came from. They don't realize that it was their sisters struggling for the better part of a century. And in fact, those were rights that weren't even achieved till rather recently, and even our own lifetime in any substantial numbers. Women had faced terrible labor exploitation. Women, children, and minorities were the reserve army of capital's labor. They were the army that capital depended on to depress wages for everybody else. They were the army that was exploited and mistreated, worst kinds of harassments. So they suffered any number of other restrictions and disabilities. So the pursuit for an expanded procedural democracy, the pursuit for the franchise, for the suffrage, for women, had very substantive interests behind it. There are very few people who throw themselves on the barricade just for the vote as an abstraction. It's they see that vote as an instrumental weapon that will gain them some access to state power and to the laws and gain them some right to citizenry and to protection. There were very real issues of survival and life chances involved in the women's struggle. Women did not agitate for a century. It took a century. And they're still agitating and fighting for their basic life chances. And we are with them, I hope, men are also. Access around such issues as abortion, ERA, etc., 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 etc. Now, women were never given the vote. I learned in school that women were given the vote in 1920. So that's nice. Who gave them the vote? Why don't they just give them the vote? And then I discovered they weren't given the vote. It took a century of agitation, torchlight parades, chaining themselves through the White House gates, getting arrested, getting thrown in prison, spit on, mistreated, force-fed. Some died of pneumonia. It took a century of this sort of thing, enduring calumny and slander and ridicule and whatever else, and then they got the vote. That's what I like about this gradualist procedural democracy. You see, it adjusts and it responds, and then things change. That wasn't the way it happened. It took a lot of fighting. I was reading something by a left journalist. I won't even say who he is. But he, because it would seem like a criticism of him, and he's a nice guy, and I don't want to make a criticism by name. But he did say something. He pointed out that, hey, he worked for a mainstream newspaper, and then he collected a pension. And he kind of sheepishly said, well, I don't like the system, but I'm willing to take the pension that it gives me. This system, this capitalist system, and he meant the capitalist system, this capitalist system has never given anyone a pension in its lifetime. It fought with tooth and nail and fang and claw against pensions. It's fought against Social Security. It fought against every substantive gain, every single gain, everything we got. None of it was ever given to us. Free education, scholarships, name it. Free lunch programs for poor kids. Name what you want, the eight-hour day. All these important democratic victories, and they're democratic victories because they are victories which help the demos, the ordinary people of this country, strengthen their lives and make them more viable, and literacy programs, name whatever you want. In every single case, the business class fought these things until maybe they saw a little opportunistic gain in it, and then they sliveled in and reluctantly went along with it. So he didn't have to be sheepish or apologetic. That pension was something that we extracted from the teeth of those companies and corporations. That pension was his. So a lot of what we're calling the system, the system, the system, a lot of that is really of our own making and product and struggle, and it's got some good things in it. And those good things are not the product of that system. Those good things are the product of our struggle against that system. Just keep that in mind. You said it, sweetheart. And they'll take back those pensions the first chance they get. And they'll take back that eight-hour day. And they'll take back that affirmative action. And they'll take back that right of abortion. And they'll take back that restriction against treating the environment as a septic tank. They'll take it back, and they are taking it back right now. They're raiding pension funds. They're forcing labor contracts to give backs on pensions, etc. Now, from this, it may be mistakenly concluded that formal democracy, political, electoral, procedural democracy, is only just so much window dressing. And it's the substantive democracy that's the only thing that counts. That's not the analysis I'm making today, brothers and sisters. I am arguing that there's a vital interplay between the two. And that sometimes, as Engels once said that, you know, he's tired of those people who only see cause here and effect there, cause, cause, effect, effect, and that there's a much more complex interplay. Let me give you an example. In the middle of the New Deal, rather early, there was passed what later became known as Labor's Magna Carta. I always learned it that way, too, in school. Labor's Magna Carta was the Wagner Act, the right to collective bargaining. It was only rather recently, by recently I mean maybe 5, 10 years ago, I forget now, when I learned that Roosevelt pushed that Wagner Act through as a sop, as actually, literally, as a window dressing. It was in response to mass unrest, and it was literally seen as a symbolic gesture to labor. And they had no idea that it was going to be taken seriously. They had no real plan for implementation. They had no, I mean, it was just a thing. And what happened was, all across the country, millions of workers seized upon the Wagner Act. The word was out. FDR is for collective bargaining. The feds have made it legal. We can have unions now. The courts won't throw you in jail, and this won't happen, that won't happen, and the sheriff won't come along and arrest you and all that sort of thing. And they took that ball that Roosevelt was just sort of bouncing in front of them. They grabbed that ball and they ran downfield with it. And you got a mass union movement that went on in the 30s. Suddenly, the rules had changed, they believed, and by their very actions, they helped change those rules. And that mass union movement brought a redistribution of income of billions of dollars. By the way, you can read a good account of this in Boyer and Moraes' book, Labor's Untold Story. The ignorance we have about the history of labor struggle in our country is really monumental. While we're maybe beginning to close the gaps and bringing women back into history and changing white history into a multiracial history, the ignorance about labor history is still quite substantial among people who sometimes call themselves progressives. And I would recommend a book like Labor's Untold Story. It makes quite some reading also. And there was a redistribution of income into the tattered pockets of those who labor, and out of the silk purses of those who live off those who labor. And that was a very real thing. But that change in procedural democracy, in fact, having FDR and the New Deal in there, feeling constrained enough and pressured enough to even pass a Wagner Act, that procedural democracy acted and had a spin-off effect and a feedback effect for substantive gains. So you can see it could work both ways. And we've had some very real economic and democratic gains. The 8-hour day, disability insurance, social security, pensions, occupational safety, environmental protections, racial and gender equality. All, by the way, vastly insufficient and in many cases leaving millions of people untouched. But still, those are gains which should mean something. I mean, you know, the struggle for racial and gender equality also has a class dimension to it. Remember, I, as a boss, I know one thing. I know that minorities and women do some of the meanest, hardest, dirtiest, underpaid work in this society. And as a boss, I don't want them thinking they're equal. They start thinking they're equal, man, that's going to mean millions of dollars in more in increased wages. More money I got to pay them, the less money there is in profits for me. It really is that simple. So, of course, I would welcome a Reagan who comes along and leads an assault against equality. Because equality of any kind, equality in any area of life, threatens class inequality. You may not think these procedural and substantive victories, democratic victories, are real or may mean much, but the ruling class does. They take them very seriously. They sat there. Ronald Reagan's greatest domestic goal was to destroy Social Security. He detested Social Security. He equates Social Security with welfare, which he hates. And he came into office, and that was one of the first things he moved against. And the only thing that stopped him was that every senator in his Republican Party, who was in the Senate, and many of the House Republican leaders, and not to mention all the Democrats, came back and said, keep your hands off Social Security. We want to get elected again. The American Association of Retired People, the AARP, with its 25 million members, was mobilized. And so that electoral democracy can operate at times as an instrument. It still is, in some issues, a soft underbelly in the capitalist state, a state that has to put up a veneer, an appearance of democracy. It gives you some democracy, an appearance of democracy, to legitimate its hold. To maintain that appearance, however, it must sometimes make substantive concessions. And so those are points of vulnerability into which we can push and push for even further gains at times. The ruling class knows that, man. And they want, if it was up to them, they would abolish OSHA. They already weakened it and undercut it. They would abolish freedom of information. They would abolish environmental protections. And in fact, they were doing those things. So those of us who say, this is all window dressing, this is all baloney, the system sucks, anything they ever do sucks, anything they ever do is just a sop or window dressing or a subterfuge, oh, they did this, oh, that's nothing. Not at all. It involves sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars. It involves the life chances of people. It may involve the survival chances of kids, whether they're going to die of toxic poisoning in some town or whether they're going to have a decent and normal life. And the guys who own the land, labor, resources, technology, and capital of this country are very annoyed with these encumbrances and these costs. And they take those gains that we have won and fought for over the decades and generations and centuries, they take them very seriously. And any chance you just go to sleep or turn around, they'll rip it right off you and take it back from you. And if it were nothing, if it was so advantageous to them, they'd let you have it. As they shift the austerity of capitalism onto people, the diseconomies of capitalism, including a chemicalized, devastated ecology, the people begin to mobilize to try to save what's theirs. And as they do that, then the attack extends not only as a battle against their standard of living, but it's also a war against their democratic rights. As I say, the constrictions on the Freedom of Information Act, constrictions on the First Amendment that have been going on, constrictions on the freedom to travel, and so forth. The Supreme Court now is going to be rewriting the rules of the game any chance they get, any time they get. So what I'm saying here is that there are many dimensions here that we have in this country. Instead of just denouncing the system as an undifferentiated object, let's remember that in a sense there are a variety of systems and subsystems, that even within the capitalist state there are rooms for debate and maneuvers. Even within the executive branch, you know, Marx is often quoted as having said that the state, the capitalist state, is the executive committee of the bourgeoisie as a whole. And he never said that. If you read where it comes from, the misquote is from the Communist Manifesto, where he said, the executive of the state is a committee of the bourgeoisie. He focused particularly on the executive. And I'm not here splitting hairs. I'm pointing out that he understood, or he opened up the possibility, that there were other areas, like the legislature, where there could be all sorts of battles and other tendencies involved. Even within the Democratic Party, there are, on occasion, candidates who are worth supporting, like Ted Weiss of New York, or Ron Dellums of California, or John Conyers of Detroit, or Harold Washington in Chicago, or Jesse Jackson in the primaries. So there are occasions when there are struggles that go on, and to say they're all alike may not be true. What happens may actually affect the life chances of many, many different people. Even within the executive, I would say there are contradictory tendencies, that the executive, you have one executive of the national security state, of the Pentagon, the NSA, National Security Agency, the National Security Council, the State Department, the Treasury Department, and then you have other tendencies in things like housing and urban development and health and education and such, to some degree. Not to say that those other agencies don't also serve capitalism in many ways. This is not to say, brothers and sisters, that democracy, that to what extent we've gained some democracy, that that democracy grows up as a product of capitalism, but as a reaction to it. That democracy that we've developed is in reaction to the capitalism that we constantly face. It's important, but I really do believe it's important to remember that we've won victories, that we can win victories, and we've made gains, and we'll win more. The tendency on the left is to lose sight of this and to emphasize how bad everything is. And by the way, that's an understandable reaction. I mean, it's very easy to make that case. You can come up here and wipe me out right now. I mean, I did write a couple of books about how bad it really is, and I wouldn't disagree with you all that much, right? But what I'm saying is, that's not enough. That's not an analysis. A pissy complaint is not an analysis of the dynamic that's going on. It's an understandable reaction, and I think I know why. Because for years, what we've faced is the apologist propagandists who have turned every vice in this society into a virtue. So our reaction is to turn every virtue into a vice. I mean, just think what they do. Every vice they come across in the political science that I learned in the 1950s, this is what we learned. Low voter turnout? Well, that proves voters are content. Lobbyists, powerful lobbyists? Lobbyists perform a very valuable information function to legislators. They give them all sorts of information that's helpful. The concentration and growth of executive power? That is called meeting the challenges of the 20th century. Exclusion of third parties? That's called a stable two-party system. And in any case, the two parties over time include the programs and special pleadings of a particular third party and bring those in and incorporate them into the two parties, which comes as news to the socialist parties that have been around for 80 years trying to get some incorporation here. So in response to that, our reaction is to turn every virtue into a vice. The vote, oh, it sucks. Just a charade. Electoral struggle, it's not important. It's another, don't, you just run their maze. Free speech, bullshit, what free speech? Individual rights, oh, a lot of window dressing. They can bop you on the head any day. I mean, well, wait a minute. Am I living in Chile? Wait a minute. We have to see differences. Analysis, the effect of a good analysis is not to blur differences, but to see them. We don't want to overemphasize them and get carried away, but there are some things here. So let's not give up on the democratic struggle. It is ultimately a revolutionary struggle. Democracy, brothers and sisters, democracy is a wonderful invention by the people over history to protect themselves from the power of wealth. That's what democracy was in Greece. That's what democracy has been ever since. It's an invention of the people, nobody else but the people. There's no great philosopher that invented democracy. There's no great political theorist that thought about it and put it together. There's no great intellectual or writer or artist who created democracy. It was the mass of people, anonymous, ordinary working people, working women and working men, people trying to survive. They're the ones who fought for, and they're the ones who've gained whatever modicum of decency and security we might have in this inhumane capitalist system and throughout history. The artists and the intellectuals are too busy being artists and intellectuals. George Sand, as she pursued her liberation in Paris, while the Paris Commune was going on, while her sisters and brothers of Paris were getting slaughtered, 25,000 of them executed, George Sand couldn't care less about the Paris Commune. She condemned it for its silliness, its excess, whatever else. Worse than George Sand was Gustave Flaubert. Flaubert, with his mutual love, ego love affair, mutual admiration society that had with Turgenev, where they wrote these disgusting letters to each other about how brilliant you are, my dear, how brilliant you are, your literature writing deathless prose. Oh, and when he took time off from that to look at the Paris Commune, all he could do was condemn it. Condemn it! Who are these people, the unwashed? The people who made the shirt, the fine silk shirt on his back and his coat, and got the tobacco for his pipe and built that fine house that he lived in and gave him the paper and the quill pens to write on. The people who prepared the food for his table.
The people who did the work of society, the work of his life, he didn't want them. How dare them rise up and think that they could become the rulers of this society? That's where your writers were. But the people knew better of themselves. And in moments they wake up, in moments they break through, in moments they take heart, and in moments they fight back. And of course, democracy needs leaders and organization. It does need organization for depending on what you're doing, where and when. And of course, democracy has produced leaders, and great ones too. From Tom Paine to Harriet Tubman to Big Bill Haywood to Martin Luther King, and you could name another 20 or 30 right in there. But even that, even take King, for instance. You know that fateful night in Montgomery? By the way, that whole Montgomery meeting that led to the Montgomery boycott, bus boycott, you know, that made history, that catapulted King into the national scene. Most of that organizing was done by A. Philip Randolph. And King wasn't even sure he was going to go to that church because this ferment, I mean, it looked a little odd. I mean, he was a respectable preacher at that time. It was only when some of his assistants came to him and said, you better get over to that church because everybody in town, every black person in town is at that church. You got to get there. And King went over and became the leader. Now, I don't want to take anything away from Dr. King. He provided tremendous resources. He provided a tremendous focus and articulation and courage and whatever else. And he gave to that movement. And he was himself a source of creation, as a leader can be. But still, it reminded me a little bit of that time Danton, when he sat there, you know, in his apartment and opened his windows and saw the Paris crowd go by. And he said, there go the people. I'm their leader. I better catch up with them. And he went running out to catch up there. So the ruling class rules, but it doesn't quite rule in the way it wants. It is very annoyed about the constrictions it must suffer. Take the very peevish reference at his very first State of the Union message that George Bush made to something called the Vietnam Syndrome. It's a syndrome, you see, a psychologistic thing. We're suffering from a Vietnam Syndrome. You know what the Vietnam Syndrome is? And for years they've been railing against the Vietnam Syndrome. When the conqueror of Grenada, Ronald Reagan, took Grenada, members of his administration came out and said, Grenada has been taken, the Vietnam Syndrome is dead. It was a very interesting point. They were saying, we can commit American troops abroad now, and everybody liked it. They committed them for 48 hours. Taking Grenada was like taking downtown Burlington. For the benefit of the videotape, somebody yelled out, let him try it. Okay, killer, sit down. Bush gets up and he starts talking about the Vietnam Syndrome. And what he means is that if we are going to pursue our global interests of imperialism, we at certain points may have very well to commit American troops. And we cannot do it. And we want to do it. We wanted to send troops into Nicaragua. We want to send troops into Panama right now. We want to send troops into El Salvador to finish it off. We wanted to send troops in any number of places. But we can't do it because of this damn Vietnam Syndrome. And their fear is that the people will wake up as they were waking up during the Vietnam War. What people began doing is beginning to question that war. And then after they start questioning the war, they began to question the leaders that produced that war. And then even more dangerously, they began to question the system that produced those leaders and saying things like, whose interests do you really represent and serve? And that is what really got them. They began to question the very legitimacy of the system itself. And the power of that system rests on maintaining a legitimacy in your eyes. Because they know something that sometimes we forget, that the people themselves are the source of power. To ask, do the people have power, is a little bit like asking, does Saudi Arabia have oil? I mean, the people are the very stuff of power, just that others have been coming in, extracting it, refining it, and using it for their own profit. I like that. That's a pretty good metaphor. Huh? Don't you think they don't know it? And they watch when they see a Soviet leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, in New York City after his UN speech, going down 7th Avenue, Broadway, and New Yorkers around him, like happy children. I mean, New York is the most jaded, cynical crowd. I'm a New Yorker myself. Bernie Sanders was an original New Yorker. You get what I mean? I mean, these New Yorkers crowding around his limo like happy children and shouting, Gorby, Gorby, Gorby. Because for the first time, because they weren't responding to his PR campaigns. The people all over the world in West Germany and elsewhere aren't responding to his clever ploys. They're not responding to his personal charm. They're responding to the substantive actions he is taking. The unilateral de-escalation of the arms race. The moves toward peace. And that's what they're doing. And don't you think our leaders were watching that when their own people in their own society around Gorby and shouting, Gorby, Gorby, Gorby. The very next day, George Shultz, who was still Secretary of State, got up on and I heard him on radio saying, well, I mean, those are interesting proposals he made at the UN, but that's no reason to go ape over it. Sure, because he knows he drives his limousine down the street, nobody crowds around it and shouts, Schultzy, Schultzy, Schultzy. So let's take heart, let's not get discouraged, let's keep fighting. When you give up, when you get discouraged, and you say, what's the use? You are doing the work of your enemies. Even in our losses, there are the seeds of victory. And they're going to lose, and we're going to win. Because they try to resist history. They try to keep history from happening. And we, in fact, are making history. We, brothers and sisters, are the history of tomorrow. Thank you.